remember looking out on the river and just seeing everybody living life. And I was stuck in this dark place.
A Bethel woman struggles with heroin addiction and highlights a growing problem in rural Alaska. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Tuesday, May 26th. Good evening, I'm Lori Townsend. Also tonight, after nearly being eliminated in Alaska, muskrats are making a comeback.
We started to gain from being none or one muskrat house per lake up to, 20 and 30 and sometimes even 100 muskrat house on a lake.
Today's broadcast of Alaska News Nightly is presented by
Alaska Pipeline Service Company, committed to safety, operating the 800-mile Trans-Alaska Pipeline since 1977.
And by
Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956.
Federal officials say in 2014 they intercepted nearly 10 times as much heroin coming into Alaska than in 2013. The growing use of the drug is impacting urban and rural areas. This is the first in a series of three stories about the impacts of heroin in Bethel and how the community is fighting it. KYUK's Daisha Eaton brings us the story of one woman's struggle to get clean in Bethel.
Don't be fooled by Tracy Faulkner's 5 foot 4 inches. The small brunette with thick hair and the nickname Malachi, which means fur hat in Yupik, is a former wrestling champion. She competed against boys in high school, going all the way to state and national competition. But in her off time, she hid a dark secret.
When I wasn't training, I would go and steal my parents' booze, find weed. But it eventually progressed to taking pills.
That started when she was 12. One semester into college, drugs started taking a priority over schoolwork. She dropped out and returned to Bethel, where she tried school again, but her drug use intervened. She started a food truck business, but couldn't maintain that either. That's when Faulkner's need for escape escalated.
Got addicted to Tramadol, started taking that. Eventually, wasn't really doing the trick for me anymore. Wanted that same high, which I first got in the beginning. Then went to moving to Oxycontin, and then went to using heroin.
Faulkner smoked it, others inject. She couldn't hold a job, and at one point was stealing to support her habit. Each high, or nifty as they're called, costs $100 here. There are no treatment programs specifically for heroin addiction in Bethel. Treatment centers in Anchorage have waiting lists. Rick Robb, Bethel's mayor, who also helps run the Yukon-Kuskokwim Health Corporation's Behavioral Health Division, which handles drug treatment, says heroin has invaded Bethel.
It seems like a few years ago it would be non-existent to rare, but now we're seeing full-blown heroin. And we're seeing it more and more. So the numbers are definitely increasing.
YKHC's Behavioral Health Division offers outpatient and inpatient treatment for those struggling to get off drugs and alcohol. But there are only 16 beds at the local center, and they're not equipped to handle heroin withdrawal. Sometimes, Rob says, people endure the painful process in the hospital emergency room or at home.
People can come in if they have a problem, and we're going to do the best we can with the resources we have to get people the help they need. I think we have to, there's some emphasis on us. We have to improve our programming specifically for heroin, and we have to learn more about it.
Faulkner says she distinctly remembers the day this winter when she gazed out the window at a friend's house and realized she wanted to make a change.
I remember looking out on the river and just seeing everybody living life, and I was stuck in this dark place.
But with no detox facility in Bethel, Faulkner realized it would have to be cold turkey. She reached out to an uncle for help. He cared for her as she went through withdrawal.
You get sick to your bones. You want to crawl out of your skin. You lay in bed all day. You have the shakes, the sweats. You're puking. You're out the other end. It's bad. It's bad, to where I couldn't get out of bed.
After detox at home, she was ready to check herself into the local treatment program run by YKHC. But it wasn't an easy process. YKHC told her it could take weeks to get an assessment necessary to access treatment. Instead of waiting, she got the assessment at a local primary care clinic and was able to check into inpatient treatment through YKHC within a few days. Rob with YKHC says he knows they need to do a better job of getting patients quickly into treatment. Now Faulkner is done with her treatment program. She says she gained strength from her ancestors and from her young son, who she says deserves to grow up in a healthy environment.
It's our younger generation that's going to be most affected by this. I mean, our heritage, our culture is going to be lost. For me, and looking at my own child, you know, I don't want him to grow up in this kind of community. I want him to grow up in the community that I was raised in, where we showed love for each other, where we cared for each other, where we stood as one.
Faulkner says she knows she's in a unique position to help unite people in the region around the issue. And now that she's clean, that'll be her focus. In Bethel, I'm Daisha Eaton.
For weeks, the Alaska legislature has been wrestling with how to cover its multi-billion-dollar budget deficit. Now one Juneau man has a modest proposal for them. Try crowdfunding? APRN's Alexander Gutierrez has this story.
For Jeff Kirsch, following the Alaska state legislature has been like watching the last seasons of Lost. It's confusing and frustrating, but you just want to stick it out for the end, which in the legislature's case is the passage of the budget.
That's like their one job, and they haven't done that.
Since the legislature ended their regular session, they've been stuck on their spending bill. They've been at an impasse over tapping the state's rainy day account, which requires a three-quarter vote. And lawmakers have been retreading the same ground in their public meetings, in their talking points, and, by most accounts, in their negotiations with each other. So Kirsch wondered if Alaskans could take action into their own hands. A few days ago, he launched a campaign to cover the deficit through GoFundMe, where internet users can contribute to causes they like.
If it works for Veronica Mars and Reading Rainbow, then it certainly might work for Alaska.
At $3 billion, the goal is a little higher than most campaigns.
It comes out to like $4,070 per person that they would have to contribute in order for the campaign to work.
It's kind of like voluntary taxation. And given how popular the idea of taxation is in Alaska, it shouldn't be too shocking that the campaign isn't raking in cash. But it has gone better than Kirsch expected.
So far, someone has contributed $50, and that wasn't even me.
Of course, the point is more to raise awareness of the political situation than to raise money. Kirsch used to do work for Comedy Central, and he still writes political satire. In the description, he encourages Alaskans to turn the budgetary shortfall into budgetary shortfall aid. He also says the legislature's message to Alaskans has been to go fund themselves. It's obvious he had fun with the idea. But as the husband to a state employee, whom, full disclosure, I know socially, Kirsch says the budget stalemate is serious. If an agreement is not reached by July 1st, up to 15,000 workers could be laid off.
People are going to lose money and people are going to lose health insurance. And I mean, there's nothing funny about that.
But then again, a lot of humor is rooted in tragedy anyway. So Kirsch is going to take this fundraiser to its logical extreme.
I really do think I am going to present a big oversized novelty check to Governor Walker if he lets me do that. I don't know. I don't know if I need to make an appointment for that or if I can just show up with it.
A spokesperson for the governor said he is open to discussions on all forms of revenue, but that they need to check with their ethics attorneys about whether they could take the money. In Anchorage, I'm Alexander Gutierrez.
A lawsuit between Nome neighbors that centered on noise and odor from one household's dog lot has been dismissed and is no longer set to go before a jury this summer. Since 2012, neighbors Kevin Bope and his wife Lynn DiFilippo have been in a legal tussle with mushers Niels Hahn and wife and mushing partner Deanna Hacker. The neighbors claim the sound and odor of the mushers' dog lot is a nuisance that makes living next door unbearable. at the mushers counter that they're simply running a dog kennel in rural Alaska. It's all complicated by the fact that the homes in question are in an unincorporated subdivision 6 miles outside of town, where the city of Nome's rules don't apply. The conflict came to a head last month when Kotzebue Judge Paul Rotman ruled the mushers' dog lot, both in terms of sound and odor, would be acceptable to a reasonable person. The case was then set to go before a jury in June until all parties agreed to dismiss the case with prejudice earlier this month. The settlement includes the option for mushers Han and Hacker to buy Bope's land at what he calls a fair market price. Han says purchasing the land is a clear way forward.
I think it's the best option for, you know, both parties. You know, I can speak for myself. It's certainly the best option for us, you know, to buy the land. And we offered Mr. Bope above market value. So I think that's the way to go.
For Bope, settling simply came down to rising legal fees. Fees, he says, would have ballooned through weeks of trial. Now he's dropping the case without any changes to a situation he says made life unbearable at home.
I made a decision because of the money, mainly. I don't want to spend any more. And it's really tiring going to court. Now this suit has beat me with money. So I really can't say much has come out in my favor.
The pending contract for mushers Hans and Hacker to buy Bope's property hinges on him relocating his house. Bope says that's easier said than done in Nome's tight housing market, but the settlement gives him a one-year window to complete the move. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, kids in Anchorage come together to celebrate hip-hop culture.
Like, I seen white people, black people, African Americans, Chinese, all just hanging out and doing the same exact dance, and it just brings us closer together.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by
First National Bank Alaska, where local knowledge and experience make the difference. We believe in Alaska. Learn more at fnbalaska.com. Equal housing lender, member FDIC. Many Alaskans who die in boating accidents don't die of hypothermia. Without a life jacket, drowning kills long before hypothermia does. More at pledgetolive.org. This message sponsored by Alaska Office of Boating Safety.
Warm, mostly dry weather continues across much of eastern interior, and that has fire managers concerned about future growth of the 70-mile fire in the eastern interior. It's so far burning in remote country north of the 70-mile river and away from the community of Eagle. Alaska Fire Service spokesman Sam Harrell says a planned burnout operation would blacken an area of heavy timber along the river to protect property on the other side.
There are couple of allotments and cabins in the area, but they are on the opposite side of the 70-mile river from the fire.
Harrell says smoke jumpers on scene will take advantage of favorable conditions to burn out the area in case a future wind shift pushes the fire back toward the river and the Eagle area. He says another group of smoke jumpers are protecting a homestead along the Yukon River at Trout Creek. The Trout and 70-mile fires are among four started by lightning in the Eagle area on Sunday. The Alaska Interagency Coordination Center reported today that 167 wildfires in Alaska have started this year and have burned more than 6,500 acres. The muskrat population has returned to levels not seen in Alaska for at least 40 years. The fur-bearing rodent was abundant in the first half of the 20th century, and harvesting muskrats for their meat and fur was a critical part of springtime subsistence. It was not uncommon for a family to harvest 1,000 or 2,000 muskrats in a season and use the furs to pay for food and supplies. Then muskrat numbers plummeted. Tim Bedoni from KIYU and Galena reports.
Galena elder Patty Nolner remembers a time when it seemed like there was a never-ending supply of muskrats, and muskrat furs were a valuable trade good.
People go out and get 40, 50, 60 muskrat, and every night they go out again to get the same amount, like if God was providing the hide for them to bring into the trading post to get their groceries for the summer, fall, and the winter, and then springtime again.
Nolner places the beginning of the muskrat decline around Galena in the early 1950s. Elsewhere, muskrats may have remained abundant until the early 1970s. Then muskrat populations dropped sharply and stayed relatively low until the past few years. U.S. Fish and Wildlife biologist and pilot Brad Scotton says that the muskrat decline happened all across North America at roughly the same time, and scientists are still debating why it happened. No single explanation works continent-wide, but in certain areas, habitat loss, environmental contamination, changes in water depth, increased predation, and overabundance help explain the decline. It is clear that muskrats are prolific breeders, and Scotton thinks that helps cast aside the theory that too much hunting and trapping caused the population collapse.
Muskrats can have like 3 litters in one season of up to 12 each, so they can reproduce really rapidly. So you can sustain very, very high harvest rates on muskrats. Even though there was local harvests that were high, probably certain lakes had a lot of harvest out of them. There's probably adjacent lakes that had very little harvests, and those muskrats will move. And as people have been saying, they're seeing them around town right now. Those are muskrats on the move in the spring, setting up shop in a new place, and presumably they'll have more litters.
State fish and game biologist and pilot Tom Seaton has been studying muskrats for more than 20 years, mainly in the Tanana and Upper Yukon drainages. In those areas, too, the muskrats were virtually extinct for a while.
In the 80s and 90s, and even in the 2000s, it was hard to find a muskrat push-up anywhere in interior Alaska. And some of the spots, like, for instance, Minto Flats, for example, was known by the fur industry for the phenomenal rats and the huge numbers that would come out of there. I've flown it several times in the 1990s and early 2000s where you could literally fly for an hour and not find one single muskrat push-up. I mean, such a drastic change.
But then Seaton and other biologists began to see an upswing in muskrat populations around the year 2004. From the vantage point of his airplane, Seaton has witnessed a steadily growing population every year since then.
We started to gain from being none or one muskrat house per lake up to, you know, 20 and 30 and sometimes even 100 muskrat house on a lake. And now, as of this year, there's even more, both Yukon Flats and Tanana Flats. There's lakes where there's hundreds of muskrat houses on a lake.
Seaton says he's excited to watch how the abundance of muskrats affects the ecosystems in which they live. Muskrats are largely vegetarian and are eaten by hawks, owls, mink, and otters. Trappers might also welcome the return of the muskrat, as muskrat furs have brought in as much as $19 a piece in a fur auction earlier this year. The average price was closer to $5 each, but demand was strong from both Chinese and Canadian buyers. Muskrat fur goes into winter hats for the Royal Canadian Mounted Police and the Canadian military. In Galena, this is Tim Bodoni.
Walrus fans everywhere can now watch the thousands of walruses sunning on Round Island live on a new set of walrus cams. KDLG's Hannah Colton has the story.
The live stream of napping walruses is sponsored by Explore.org, an organization that's installed these wildlife cams all over the world.
And so our first cam in Alaska was at Katmai with Ranger Roy and with the brown bears and the salmon.
That's Charles Annenberg Weingarten, the founder of Explore.org and the vice president of the Annenberg Foundation. The idea for the cams, he says,
was to allow people to get up close and personal with nature, and hopefully through it develop a relationship again and reconnect, to kind of fall in love with the world again.
Weingarten says he's always had an interest in sea life, but walruses especially captured his attention.
You know, they're vocal. They sing, they speak, they're kind of lazy, which, you know, they look when they're out. Of course, they're great swimmers, which I relate to. I love the way they kind of move their heads. The tusk is just amazing. I mean, they're swimming tanks. They're 2,000 to 4,000 pounds.
Weingarten was especially excited to capture walruses in a place as hard to reach as Round Island.
Not only is it remote, it's very weather prohibitive. So it's very difficult to fly there and different things. It's not an easy journey. So to be able to connect the world to such a pearl of the planet, such a sacred place, is amazing.
Right now, the cameras are live streaming from 2 different beaches on Round Island, where thousands of male walruses haul out to rest in the spring and summer. Weingarten says it's a party that everyone is going to want to check out.
Now I've almost made it comical, because now that I'm watching them on the live cams, I've almost dubbed this summer, there's a summer of blubber. So, you know, just like enjoy and celebrate and to get your tusk on. But I just think walruses, it's a magical place.
The Annenberg Foundation also provided funding to keep Round Island staffed after last year's budget cuts. In Dillingham, I'm Hannah Colton.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by ConocoPhillips, investing in oil and gas production and creating jobs and business opportunities for Alaskans. ConocoPhillips, Alaska's oil and gas company. If you're ready to quit tobacco, Alaska's Tobacco Quit Line can help with free confidential coaching and support services through the telephone and online. Now introducing Text to Quit, a way to help you use medications correctly, manage urges, and prevent relapse all from your mobile phone. Call 1-800-QUIT now or visit AlaskaQuitLine.com for more information. This message sponsored by Alaska's Tobacco Prevention and Control Program.
The city of Houston in the Matsu Valley is facing such severe financial woes that all but three city employees have been furloughed. Houston Mayor Virgie Thompson is working without pay, and volunteers are keeping the wheels of city government running. KSKA's Ellen Lockyer has more.
Houston, on the Parks Highway in the Susitna Valley, has hit the financial wall. Houston Mayor Virgie Thompson blames the crisis on unpaid property taxes.
There's a little over $35,000 delinquent. In other words, they haven't paid it. So that's $35,000 right now that we don't have that we projected to have.
The city of 2,000 residents is just beyond commuting distance to Anchorage. There are few local jobs, and state revenue sharing funds from this fiscal year are running out. Thompson says the city's greatest source of revenue is property taxes, and that the much ballyhooed Alaska Railroad spur linking Houston and Port McKenzie is not helping to bring in any money.
Not yet. You know, part of that is owned by the borough and you can't tax the borough. The other part is owned by the state. You can't tax the state. So even though the infrastructure is there, basically until private sector comes in and does something with it, it's not taxable.
Thompson says she's putting in the 80 hours a month required by city law, but is not turning in her time card to the finance clerk so as to keep her $1,500 a month salary in the coffers. The finance clerk, along with the city's fire chief and city clerk, are the only Houston City employees now drawing a paycheck. The city is not legally allowed to borrow money. City sales taxes bring in some revenue during the tourism season, which has barely started, and next year's state revenue sharing is still on the horizon. There is some money in the Matanuska-Susitna Borough budget for Houston, $9,500 for the fire department, and a $21,000 block grant. The Matsu Borough budget for next year has been approved, but is awaiting expected vetoes from Borough Mayor Larry DeVilbiss. Thompson says the borough collects the property taxes and sends out the delinquent notices, but it can be up to 3 years before any foreclosure action is taken on non-payers.
I mean, we might be worse off than a lot of other cities, but look at the state. I mean, it's a domino effect. It goes down. Who knows? Half of those people that are going to be laid off up at the slope actually live in the city of Houston, and they can't afford to pay their property taxes. So it affects us.
Two positions, a full-time public works director and one part-time job, are furloughed. One position will not be rehired, and all the firefighters have been furloughed from duty shifts, although they will be paid if called on to fight a fire. I'm Ellen Lockyer.
Hip-hop is more than just music and dancing. It's a culture based on bringing people together. That was the message during this weekend's All Tribes Hip-Hop Cultural Heritage Summit at Begage Middle School in East Anchorage. From the Urban Affairs Desk, KSKA's Ann Hillman attended.
There you go, dude. Okay, so this is what I want you to do. I want you to do this. I want you to go like this. Yep, and I want you to do this.
Local breakdancer Brianna McMillan is surrounded by an eager group of elementary school students who are spinning on their backs and standing on their heads. Camo sweatpants hang from her petite but powerful frame, baseball hat askew on her head. She's providing an impromptu dance lesson.
Like this? Spin. Like this? Spin? Yeah, just like that. And go to your head. I know how to do this. Yeah?
Yeah. McMillan, also known as B-Girl Snap One, started listening to hip-hop as a teenager at South High in Anchorage.
I could relate it to almost like an adrenaline rush on a nice sunny day. Just that rush of good feeling and just like that breath of fresh air that life is really good.
But she says she couldn't really express what she felt physically.
I loved music, but I never felt very rhythmically coordinated. And I was more of an athlete more than anything. I didn't know how to dance. And when I saw breaking, I saw all the athleticism in it and all the crazy moves that they were doing. And they were still dancing to the music that was just catching my ear.
McMillan says through breaking, she met kids from all over town and from a variety of different backgrounds. She soon learned that hip hop isn't just creativity, it's self-discipline. She's using that skill as a Black Hawk mechanic with the National Guard. She says hip hop is also about understanding that people are just people. Summit organizer and hip hop artist George Martinez explains that hip hop was created in New York in the 1970s as a way to unify people.
Because fundamentally it was a group of people who are unlikelies, the write-offs, the people who are poor, the people of color in the South Bronx who everyone forgot about, who decided that just with cardboard boxes they can transform a sidewalk into a dance studio and give each other hope.
Martinez says hip-hop values are peace, knowledge, and having fun. The culture gives people tools to compete and air their differences through non-violent creative means. He says underground battles are happening all the time in Anchorage to see who raps better or dances better. Samuel Johns grew up in Copper Center, living a traditional lifestyle of hunting and fishing with his family. But he also listened to a lot of Tupac. He told the crowd of 40 youth and community members that it was Tupac's storytelling through music that taught him how to connect with older generations. Now, he's known as AK Rebel, who raps about ending domestic abuse and other violence.
When I do music, I don't make music that's irrelevant. I make music that will be remembered 10 years from now because it meant something, because it's a real story. It's not something that's just for clubs. It's not something that people could just dance to.
Outside of the school, tall white wooden boards lean against a lamppost, temporarily blank canvases. 14-year-old Quali Phillips shakes a can of spray paint. He's learning about another element of hip-hop, graffiti art, as he reflects on the messages of the rappers he likes.
Just to be true to myself and don't make an impersonation of anybody, like, not to be someone, like, not to portray myself in a negative light.
12-year-old Layla Kramer says the music and the dancing unite the kids at Begich Middle School.
If, like, a new dance comes out, like, all the kids are doing it, everybody's doing it, like with the whip, the little Einstein's music. Like, I seen white people, black people, African Americans, Chinese, all just hanging out and doing the same exact dance, and it just brings us closer together.
She grabs some paint and leans over a friend to add her mark to the board. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. We had reports tonight from Daisha Eaton in Bethel, Matthew Smith in Nome, Dan Bross in Fairbanks, Tim Bodoni in Galena, Hannah Colton in Dillingham, and Ellen Lockyer and Ann Hillman in Anchorage. APRN's Alexander Gutierrez also reported from Anchorage. Our editor and producer is Andy Feit. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Monica Goki is our web producer. And I'm Lori Townsend. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible by
Doyon Limited, Interior Alaska's regional native corporation providing oilfield services, government contracting, and natural resource development in Alaska and across the nation. Information at doyon.com.
And by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com.
The Medallion Foundation and Federal Aviation Administration set standards for the operation of aircraft and airports. More information at faa.gov/go/flyalaska. This message is sponsored by the Medallion Foundation. Alaska Pacific University offers an affordable education, small class sizes, and life-friendly schedules designed to support your personal and professional goals. Graduate with work-ready experience in the career field of your choice. Apply now for fall 2015. Find out more about APU's Promise Tuition Grant and other scholarships at alaskapacific.edu. This message is sponsored by APU.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.